Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway. It's a chilly Sunday here in Brooklyn, and we have a holiday coming around. Not tomorrow's holiday, which is MLK Day, and hopefully many of you guys get some time off to cook, perhaps. But we are going to have Chinese New Year in just a few weeks, February 8th. It's coming up early this year. So I'm really excited to have a guest who knows how to throw a party. And it doesn't have to be Chinese New Year, but I know she has plenty of tips for that. Her name is Danielle Chang. She is the founder of the Lucky Rice Festival, a national celebration of Asian cultures and cuisines that's taken place in more than seven cities. And you might recognize her as the creator of Lucky Chow, a PBS series about Asian food and culture in America. Her new book is called, of course, Lucky Rice, Stories and Recipes from Night Markets, Feasts, and Family Tables. And Danielle Chang is on the line. How are you?
Hi, Kathy. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks so much for joining us.
Of course. No, I'm thrilled, actually. When you called to invite me to join the show, I actually had your book, Food of Taiwan, on my coffee table, having just read through it the previous weekend and trying to decide what to cook from it.
That's so funny. It's like actually kind of creepy, like how much we have in common
and
reading
really
your book.
Yeah, it really is. I know. I can't believe that we haven't had a full conversation until now.
Yeah, definitely. Well, long overdue. But here we are.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you're born in Taiwan, but moved to New York, just America, not New York, though, when you were about five?
Yeah, I actually moved to L.A. and then Houston, and then before settling back to New York, to New York for college.
So like me, and like many folks who are Asian American, you grew up with a mixture of both Asian food cultures as well as the tantalizing taste of American food and all that entails.
I actually grew up with a really Chinese palate because I lived in Taiwan until I was about five and then went back and spent at least a third of my year there through summer holidays and Chinese New Year celebrations. So I have a very Chinese stomach. I don't think I had a pizza or a French fry until I was in third grade or so.
Yeah. Well, it definitely shines throughout your book how much you've held to the traditions as well as embraced others. So if you don't mind, I kind of wanted to read a little bit from your introduction, which I hope helps summarize the wonderful flavor,
please.
Okay, great. So you write, we're not just becoming more adventurous eaters, we're also more knowledgeable about Asian culture. We see that the largest continent is not just one monolith of chopsticks and soy sauce, but rather a collection of interwoven yet disparate cultures and cuisines. 10 years ago, for instance, when takeout menus still lumped Thai, Chinese, and Japanese dishes into one cuisine, if I told people that I was born in Taiwan, many would then innocently regale me with stories of their Thailand vacation. I've gotten that too. But not anymore. And I like to think that's because our bellies have taught us well. And you go on to talk about, you know, this growing sense of food explorations about and knowledge in America about Asian cultures. It seems like we're at, you know, Asian food 2.0 you know, as a culture here. And you're exploring that here. So it's a great time for this book. I'm really excited.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I'm really excited. Just like your book, I think we're at this point in our dining vocabulary where we're welcoming foods that weren't previously well known here, like mm-hmm. foods of Taiwan. I mean, certainly the Taiwanese have been in America for, well, you and I both know, you know, mm-hmm. many, many decades. But their food has always been kind of relegated to subcultures, and it's finally now that you know, everybody is enjoying it, and you see it on menus.
You do.
Outside of Taiwanese or Chinese restaurants, and that's really great. I think it's through that lens that we're learning all about these cultures.
Like
you just read in the intro.
Mm-hmm. It's so exciting, and I love it when I hear. Okay, so I want to like share maybe a little devil's advocate story because I love it when I hear friends who are American or who knows what other culture, you know, talk about with like this authority about things like, I don't know, pork belly, like guabao or something or miso. I don't know. And it's, I don't know, there's also something a little weird when I see like on new American menus, this really crazy uses of Asian ingredients in juxtapositions.
Right.
Do you ever get this creeping sense of like, oof, I'm not sure about that.
Well, I think as long as it's not couched as, this is authentic, this mm-hmm. is the real deal, you know, I spent 3 months in Thailand, and therefore I can cook better than your Thai grandmother. Right. You know, as long as it's not under those pretenses, I actually quite love it mm-hmm. When people outside of the culture are cooking with, you know, Asian ingredients or techniques or kind of wrapping flavors into their heritage cooking. Mm-hmm. I think that we're kind of beyond ethnicity in that, or those boundaries, those ethnic boundaries, so that anybody can cook anything and make it taste delicious.
Right.
And this kind of this backlash, right? I mean, we all remember wasabi mashed potatoes and horrible, you know, Asian fusion cuisine of the 80s.
Or soy sauce directly.
But I think we've moved beyond that. And I love how, like, classically French-trained chefs are playing with, say, miso mm-hmm. or with... you know, dashi and in adding nuances to their cooking.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that there are any limitations to like who's allowed to do that? You know, trained chefs mm-hmm. or somebody who's just stumbled upon soy sauce for the first time? Do you think that that it just matters about whether it tastes good?
Well, I think that there are fewer rules, you mm-hmm. know, when it comes to Asian food and how people are assimilating it into their cooking. I'm not sure whether, this is certainly not the case in Asia, you know, if mm-hmm. you go to a Chinese banquet table, you know, our dads are not going to eat a bastardized version of a traditional Chinese soup, for instance, I'm assuming, if your dad is anything like mine. But I think that chefs have given a lot of liberty with Asian food, like mm-hmm. adding soy sauce into their, you know, uni spaghetti. And I kind of love it that there are no rules when it comes to Asian food.
It is really interesting. I began thinking along the lines of like, you know, where is this? Is there a line that you can be? That can cross into where it might be offensive because a couple weeks ago there was like a little outburst at Oberlin College where the students were protesting the quote unquote cultural appropriation of some of the Asian quote unquote foods that the cafeteria was preparing.
Oh, so, really? Yeah. How interesting. I'll have to look at that up.
Yeah. So,
I guess, they were Asian students who were protesting this cultural appropriation?
And other ethnicities of students.
Oh.
Yeah. Pretty. It must have been terrible food, though, I'm thinking.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do hate it when, you know, as I think the earlier generation of Asian food where all of these different diverse cuisines are lumped together. Mm-hmm. And it's like, this is Asian food in a takeout box. and it's nasty, and it has no real reflection to mm-hmm. how proper Asian food should taste. But at the same time, I also think it's funny when people always ask me, even today, well, hey, what's your favorite Chinatown restaurant? As if to say that, you know, Chinatown is the most authentic place where you can get Chinese food, and that authenticity equals quality, and it just mm-hmm. doesn't. I mean, you know, you can go to Chinatown and get food prepared by, you know, immigrants, kind mm-hmm. of like fresh off the boat, sorry, but, you know, who were formerly engineers and not really trained to be cooks in the kitchen. And that's not to say that it's going to be better. It's probably not than somebody like Andy Ricker,
right.
for instance, who, you know, studied and has cooked Asian food for as his career.
You know, there also seems to be a growing sense of flamboyance with regards mm-hmm. to, like, mashups and, you know, I guess I don't want to use the word fusion because it was so stigmatized before, but
exactly.
it really is fusion. There, for instance, Dale Talda, one of the top chef mm-hmm. like stars, his new cookbook is called Asian American, subtitled Proudly Inauthentic Recipes.
Right.
And there also was a Lucky Peach Chinese cookbook that
yes.
was like inauthentic Chinese recipes.
Right.
You know, there's
right.
this wink, wink, nod, nod, tongue in cheek sense to it.
Yeah.
Which is interesting as well.
Right. It is. I kind of think of Chinese American food as its own category. Mm-hmm. So it has its history, it has its flavor components. It's born of a certain time, you know, primarily when the Immigration Act was lifted and, you know, there was a flood of Chinese immigration into the U.S. in the 60s. And those people who catered to a broader audience who wanted, you know, your typical kind of Sunday takeout Jewish, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. Upper West Side dinner. And it's the food that I grew up with and that I kind of have a nostalgia for in a way.
Yeah.
And I recently read that there are these expats who have moved to Beijing who've opened an Asian American diner because mm-hmm. they miss those dishes like General Tso's chicken
wow.
that they couldn't get in Beijing. So I don't know. It's its own category as
right.
much as Szechuanese or Taiwanese or Shanghainese cuisine is.
Mm-hmm. And certainly in for anyone in New York and probably many other big cities, we see more and more of these sort of fun mashups becoming part of the norm. And, you know, like, for instance, kimchi tacos is, you know, mm-hmm. bulgogi tacos is like, I don't know, the new cream cheese and bagel or something. Like,
well, I mean, I actually write about that in my book mm-hmm. because I feel that kimchi tacos should be the dish, the official dish for Los Angeles because mm-hmm. it just captures the zeitgeist of that city and all of the battles and the strifes that for Koreatown, for instance, has had, you know, since the riots in the 90s. And, you know, now Koreatown is this booming neighborhood where, you know, Hispanics and Koreans live side by side and in harmony and that marriage has given birth to the kimchi taco. So I think that
that's wonderful.
Is the most kind of authentic product mm-hmm. that you could find, you know, most authentic outgrowth of two ethnicities.
A melting pot, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a much more lovely story than something like the banh mi, which was invented during the mm-hmm. French colonization
right.
of Vietnam.
Yeah, so. I mean, so many dishes were, and yeah. it's amazing how many. There are dishes like that, and like chicken tikka masala as well. You know mm-hmm. that have then now found so much love mm-hmm. back home.
I mean, you have so many great ideas here. You have recipes for kimchi tacos, Jewish pastrami egg rolls.
Well, I certainly can't take credit
Roman,
for all that.
Chinese
you know, I mean, the recipes are all mine, so mm-hmm. I recreated them in my kitchen. But what I wanted to set out to do with the book is to talk about the kind of where we're at in our dining vernacular when it comes to Asian food and mm-hmm. how much of an influence Asian culture has had just across America in our backyards. through its food culture. And so I'm fortunate that with the Lucky Rice Festival, I've been able to travel a lot across the U.S. and to see how Asian food culture manifests itself in different cities, whether it's L.A. or Miami, and soon to be Houston. That's our new market this year.
Oh, cool.
And so, like the pastrami egg roll, that's something that, you know, Ed Schoenfeld and Joe Ning serve with great pride at Red Farm.
Mm-hmm.
And the kimchi tacos, obviously the most famous incarnation of that is Roy Choice.
Mm-hmm. In L.A., yep.
Koji Chuck. So, you know, what the book does is to talk about these kind of food trends or flavor profiles that are gaining currency amongst our diners today.
Absolutely. And you have a great perspective because you've been throwing these festivals or feastivals and you get to see people's reactions. So mm-hmm. I'm curious, like, because it seems like these ideas, they throw so many different people like a rope and uh-huh. something to attach to and love. What is your overall observation of everyone's reactions to some of these dishes?
I think everybody is curious and loves Asian food. You know, I have this right, really cheesy saying, which is,
factor.
If we are what we eat, then we're all part Asian. Because I feel like it's become a part of our everyday grub. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's you can get banh mi sandwiches at Pret a Manger. In fact, you can get Korean stews there nowadays.
Oh, wow.
You know, next to that, Hale and Hearty, they have like Thai coconut curry soups every day. I mean, it just, the flavors are the fish sauce, the fermentation, a lot of street food flavors, you know, mm-hmm. the use of squid or, you know, black bean sauce. All of these things are no longer foreign to mm-hmm. any American diners. And so, you know, I think people are just interested in Asian food, period, and that's what's given us the privilege to kind of bring the festivals across the country. At the same time, I'm just so pleased, and I've learned so much from how chefs locally, and you know, interpret and recreate traditional Asian dishes and make mm-hmm. it something really personal.
Yeah.
Like when you're in L.A. and San Francisco and New York, these are obviously hubs for Asian immigration and just Asian Americans. So it's not a huge surprise that mm-hmm. you know you would have a very well educated diner or guest. But when you go down to Miami, which we do every year, that's actually the you know only metropolis in the U.S. practically that has wow. such a tiny Asian population. It only has 3% Asians. And yet, the festival there is wildly popular.
No kidding.
Because I think people are traveling to Asia through their imagination, and yeah. food is the current that allows them to reach that, you know, their destination. And so, if you think about Miami, you know, it's a big eating and drinking city, but yet, most of the most popular restaurants there are kind of like these big box Asian places,
mm-hmm.
like a Tao
yeah.
or Mr. Chow or Hakkasan, Zuma, Sushi Samba, those types of places. And it's
fancy, right?
There's so much secondary migration, actually, mm-hmm. from Asia to South America and Latin America, and then now the U.S.
Cuba.
Via Miami as a port. That,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you think about it in that context, it really does make sense, and it's just, I love it that food is like a lens through which people can journey mm-hmm. to Asia.
Well, certainly many of these recipes have that great like wow factor and cleverness. So I want to talk a lot more about how you can experience these at home rather than at you know, a truck or something.
Mm-hmm.
Right when we come back after a quick little commercial break.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
All right, we're back chatting more with Danielle Chang, author of Lucky Rice. So Danielle, you have like a whole chapter here and many tidbits of info on throwing feasts and banquets and parties. So I'm looking at this one right now, Lucky Feast, where you have, it looks like a pretty good menu for the new year. I see firecrackers here and red envelopes on the spread.
Yes.
So,
yes,
for anyone who wants to make a few fun dishes to celebrate the holiday, what do they need to do?
You know, the first thing I say about Chinese New Year is, again, there are no rules, because I think it can be pretty intimidating when people think about throwing their own kind of Chinese banquet for the New Year, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden they're accosted yeah. by all of these rules, like, you must serve dishes in eights, the fish has to be whole, you know, with its head pointing to the guest of honor.
I kind of think the fish needs to be whole.
Must wear red, etc. And I think, you know, these are okay. all great, fun things. That make Chinese food that much more appetizing mm-hmm. And exciting to you know, somebody that's not familiar with the culture.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it can be intimidating. So what I hope to do with this book is to demystify a lot of that, so that you can cook one dish from that chapter, or you can basically mix and match dishes from different chapters of the book to create your own meal, something that suits your appetite.
Cool.
But for the Chinese New Year, you know, we do talk a lot about lucky foods mm-hmm. because luck is, you know, a huge part of, I think, what sets Chinese food apart from a lot of other cuisines.
Right. No kidding. That's why you named your book in festivals Lucky Rice.
yeah. Well, I mean, I just think luck is one of those kind of commonalities that a lot of Asians have, you know, this wish for auspiciousness and good fortune and the belief that food can bring that to you.
Yeah.
It's such a great hope. And then mm-hmm. rice, of course, is the foundation of most Asian foods. And so that's mm-hmm. why, you know, we named the book and the festival Lucky Rice.
Mm-hmm.
And the Chinese, you know, take eating very seriously, as you know.
True.
And the Chinese New Year is really just one giant feast, as you've experienced. It mm-hmm. takes place over almost 2 weeks. And it's the biggest holiday in the world because, mm-hmm. well, there's more Chinese than any other population in the world. And they literally just take off. Like, everything in China closes. Everything in Taiwan closes. Like, don't, you know, you just cannot go to the bank or the post mm-hmm. office or anything on those days. So everybody's at home feasting and cooking and eating. And so there's two types of feasting that takes place, you know, the kind of home-style feasting where you gather around with your aunts and make dumplings at home. And that's just an all-day experience. And the main point of that really is just the gossip that happens around the dining table. You know, it's just
catching
an activity
up,
that's
so true.
Hand
like
in
a knitting
hand
circle.
With, you know, hanging out at home over the holidays. Whereas family and the friends are the most important part of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we always make dumplings around the New Year and then boil them at midnight mm-hmm. as a midnight snack.
Oof, yum.
And then what we've gotten to doing lately is to put kind of like a lucky coin in certain ones of those dumplings so
Ooh.
That, you know, these auspicious eaters can be imbued with something extra lucky if they happen to come across one of those dumplings.
That's
but
so
then,
fun.
You know, also there's the banquet, the more formal recipes, like the whole fish, which is so simple to make, and yet can be intimidating to a lot who haven't tried it.
Sure, but, you know, your recipes are really clear, and it's fun to learn also about why some of these dishes are considered lucky, like, and a lot of it is phonetic translation,
mm-hmm.
right? So the word for you, fish, it sounds like something auspicious.
Yeah. It sounds, it's auspicious for wealth.
Right. And then longevity noodles, anything long seems to symbolize long life, which is why we see noodles.
Yeah, so you always have longevity noodles, you know, at birthday celebrations where it's just slurp, 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 you know, because you never want to cut that noodle, because cutting into noodles is like cutting into your life.
Good to know. One little tidbit, which is really fun, is especially if you want to make money in the next year, is the dumplings are considered lucky because the shape resembles the ancient golden little ingots?
Yes, like exactly. This was the ancient form of currency. So,
so
people used to make those ingots and throw them into rivers to kind of scare away all spirits as well.
Let's just
fish to eat something else, not our spirits.
But these are all just fun things to keep in mind. Okay, so you also have pork belly. These are all really appealing. I love the lion's head meatballs. So comforting.
Yeah, no, the foods are beautiful, and they're really each of them are home-style dishes that you can make and have any time of the year. But together, when served together, they really do form kind of an auspicious, traditional Chinese New Year menu. You know, foods like turnip cakes are so simple. It's really radishes and rice flour, and it's something that, you know, you can find steamed or pan-fried at most dim sum tables. But they're also always served at Chinese New Year because, of course, the word radish is a homophone for something auspicious as well in Chinese. So I just love how these, you know, everyday foods are imbued with special significance when brought out during a particularly important date on the calendar.
Nice. And what else can folks do at home to kind of spice up their feast with a little bit of, I don't know, festive games or activity?
Mahjong is always good.
Okay.
You know, if you're talking about luck and taking a chance, hey, you never know. It's the idea of gambling, I think, and of luck, auspiciousness, that always ties into many a Chinese, you know, dinner table. And then it's just such a really festive time where everybody gets together, so it's kind of defined by chaos. You know, the Chinese have this saying "zhenao," where it's literally hot and noisy, and that's a good thing because people love just being like loud and hot and noisy and eating a lot and, you know, talking into the night, eating more, drinking more, you know, burping loudly. Just that kind of real, you know, chaos that takes place around the dinner table and the feasting really defines the Lunar New Year.
Wow. I love that you also explained that, like, hot and noisy is used a lot in describing night markets.
Yes.
And that's in a good way, though.
yeah, where it's just, like, the sensory overload is what you go to night markets for.
Right. Yeah.
It's that controlled chaos that I love about it, and that sense of discovery. It's like you go for your favorite stalls, but then you always invariably come across something you've never had. And that's really what I hope that the book will do, and that's what I hope the festivals do as well, is that you may go there because you know you want to make that your old man, that, you know, Taiwanese beef noodle soup, or but then along the way you'll come across something that's new, and through the lens of making that dish, you'll learn something new about the culture, and its people and its history, possibly even. And that is really, to me, what the book is all about.
Yeah, and now you can make that at home, following all these great recipes. I mean, it's really, really. Thank you so much. It's really great for sharing.
I'm loving your book because I'm learning so much from it. I mean, even though I, you know, had grown up in Taiwan, a lot of the food that I ate there wasn't necessarily Taiwanese.
Yes.
And I didn't really understand all about the, you know, Taiwanese politics and, you know, the economy and history and how that plays into its food. Yeah. Are you following the elections?
Well, it just happened. Yep.
Yeah.
Newsflash. We have a first female president of Taiwan yesterday.
Yeah.
And China does not like her at all.
Right. So that's topic of debate, discussion, yes, on every Taiwanese table today.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. That's true. And also during the dumpling folding circles, too, maybe.
Yes.
So Danielle, that's about all the time we have, but let us know, do you have any upcoming festivals that we can check out?
Yeah, well, we're going to be kicking off our calendar actually during another really festive time, which is Taisonkon. It's the Thai New Year, and
okay,
that happens in mid-April.
Perfect.
And from there, we're going to be coming to New York, reprising our large-scale night markets before heading out west to L.A., San Francisco, Houston, and then Miami.
All right.
So check it all out at LuckyRice.com. Mm-hmm. The book is available. Comes out January 26th. It's on for pre-sale right now at Amazon.com. So anywhere,
all right,
or anywhere else you can find the book. And I hope that your readers and your listeners will all, you know, enjoy the holidays with the help of Lucky Rice.
Absolutely. We'll stay tuned, too, at LuckyRice.com. So, thank you so much for your time, Danielle.
Thank you, Kathy. And let's cook together sometime,
yes,
soon.
Yes, let's do it. Happy feasting.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Ooh, I like the way you do. Whoa, the way you took it so slow.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.